The Creative Business Podcast is brought to you by Noosey. Online proposals made simple for creative businesses. Visit noosey.com to learn how your business can start winning more projects today.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Business Podcast, the podcast that aims to help you build a better, more successful creative business. Hello, Marcus.
Hello. Good to talk to you today.
Yes, we were just talking there before recording. What are we going to talk about today? Perhaps we should plan this in advance.
Well,
that's... And what did we come up with this week?
We should plan this in advance, but we came up with managing creative experts. I know. And I find these to be the hardest kind of people to manage because, frankly—
What are you talking about? We're an easy bunch.
Well, you creative people. But let's step back. So there's two parts to these people we want to talk about how we manage, or maybe we even talk about how we lead them. And that is, they are experts at what they do. These are not McDonald's workers. These are not people who dig a ditch for a living. If you run a creative business, you probably have experts like programmers, designers, copywriters, UX people. I don't know, Nathan, what other kind of experts might be in their world?
Well, I think actually taking a step back even further, I think even those of us who aren't running a business with, should we say, employees, even the freelance consultant, contractor, designer, developer is always, at some point, is going to end up working with contractors as well. You know, a big project comes along and the work needs to be delegated, you know, because you can't do everything, you can't be on everything. So I think, yeah, adding to what you said, you know, you could be working with designers, with developers, with marketers, with SEO people, with social media experts, with some, even, you know, within social media, somebody who exclusively works with Facebook ads, with Twitter. I mean, you know, I mean, this just goes on and on and on. You could be working with any number of people in any field. And I think the more we move forward with this online creative world, business, SaaS, digital agencies, I think that we just create job titles, I think, every couple of months. So who knows? In 6 months, you could be working with another 50 job titles. But I think it all comes down to the same thing. You know, we all fall under that creative employee spectrum or having to manage or having to work with. So, and I know you've got a ton of experience, right? Because you, when you were running Creo, you were three managing partners, is that right?
Yep, three managing partners, and then about 20 employees and about 60 contractors.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea it was actually that big.
It was pretty good size. And I don't think anybody, we all strive to hire and work with experts. I mean, this is sort of the age of the niched expert, it feels like, you know, in our day and age, nobody represents themselves as a novice. I mean, that's a poor way to get a job anyway. So we have all these people around us that are experts, certainly in their mind and hopefully in our mind as well. And then the other thing is, there's all kinds of weird niches. Like you said, some people are even experts in Facebook ads. And I ran into somebody the other day who was an expert in Facebook video ads. The specializations keep getting more and more narrow. But as a business owner, sometimes all you really need to do is get stuff done. And you almost don't care about the, I don't know, this is how I felt. After a while, I just didn't care about somebody's unique snowflake positioning for themselves, which maybe that wasn't very nice, but I was a business owner. I had to make money.
And how did you get past that then? Because we're all taught and we all profess to teach as well, you know, that we should be pushing our unique snowflakeness, you know, so maybe that's for another episode because, okay, so you're a busy agency owner, but you don't, what were you valuing more than their uniqueness then?
Well, that's a good question. Stepping back
maybe
a little bit.
Maybe the conversation has just taken a turn, but that's okay.
Maybe it has. I think we'll come back to it. What I really wanted as an agency owner was smart generalists in an area. And by smart, what I meant as smart, humble people who would work as a team. And I didn't really want, if I had a team, and for example, our team looked like this. We had a series of programmers. We had, say, eight programmers. And then we had about four or five designers, and we had two or three copywriters, and we had an account manager and a project manager. The programmers eventually migrated to specialize into a mobile and a web team. And then within the web team, they specialized into the front end and the back end. And then eventually we added somebody we called the DevOps. Well, this sounded great to have all these skills, but what I realized was at first I didn't set the team up properly. What I did was I gave people titles that reflected the kind of work they wanted to do. Like, you're a front-end engineer, or you're a front-end designer, or you're a DevOps person, or you're a back-end programmer, or you're a UX person. The reality was all these people had a whole bunch of skills, but between my kind of only thinking about them in a certain way as one kind of skill and their desire to specialize, I actually ended up creating silos. And these silos were completely unintentional. Oftentimes they were just one person, but that one person started to tell me things like, well, I don't really, like, I'm the DevOps engineer. I'm a front-end person. I don't do back-end. And I would look at this guy or this gal and I would think, when I hired you, you were building general purpose PHP websites. You told me you kind of did it all, but now you want to be seen as a front end person because that's what you prefer. That's what you enjoy. And I tried really hard for a while to honor that, to kind of, oh, well, I understand. I won't give you that work. But finally, as a business owner, I literally just, we weren't big enough, even with all our people, to have extreme specialization. And so I started asking people to be more generalists. And that meant quit worrying about the title you have, quit worrying about, you know, how work comes onto your queue and is it perfect, but instead be collaborative, work with the other members of the team, and frankly, do whatever it takes to get it done. And bring all those front-end skills, but don't feel like any other kind of work just is beneath you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear how that went down, though, because, you know, we are a funny bunch, and we do like the titles that we give ourselves. So how did that go down? I mean, did you have to sell it, or was it just, you know, this is the way it is, or you're out the door?
Well, I think this might be the first principle on the idea of managing creative experts. You always have to sell it. If you say, well, this is the way it is, maybe they won't leave immediately, but generally, this is the funny thing about experts. They want to have a lot of control about how they do their work. They're less picky about what work they do within a certain context or the kind of project they work on. For example, my backend programmer would tell me, oh, I don't care what kind of website we're making. I just always want to do the backend. Okay. But the reality is as a creative business owner, you don't always have the luxury of partitioning work that way. And if that might actually leave some of your best people on the bench. So I had to introduce the idea that people could have a focus of their work, but we were all to be generalists, to bring whatever skills it took to the table, to the project, to get things done, to make the client brilliantly happy. And we needed to, and I basically sat everybody down and said that all the handoffs and all the that's not my job kind of talk was causing costs and time to skyrocket. And frankly, at the end of the day, people weren't communicating as much. They weren't talking about things because they perceived that, for example, design isn't everyone's job. Usability isn't everyone's job. Testing isn't everyone's job. It's only one person's job. And so if I just do my part, I can put on blinders and then not worry about the overall project outcome. What I needed people to do was to start to be very concerned about the overall project outcome.
I was skeptical. I got to admit, when you said about you wanting everyone to be sort of generalists, you know, that like sort of went against everything I've been learning, you know, over the last maybe sort of 7-8 years or something. And I was skeptical. But that sort of the way you brought it back around there at the end, you know, it's everyone's job to be on, you know, to be bug testing. It's everyone's job to be on the usability. It's everyone's job. From that side, I can definitely sort of say yes to that because, you know, we see it in Nusi, you know, being a very small team. If I was just to say to, you know, all all quality testing, all, you know, bug search and everything is all down to Michael because he's a developer, then that would be pretty, right. That would be pretty unfair and pretty difficult, you know? I think I can begin to see it from that side, I think, yeah.
Well, that's, and maybe, I don't know, for me, you know, you and I have talked a lot about niching down, right? And we know Philip Morgan and we know all these people. I think niching is so important for a business. Because when you're a business, you have to focus on the market you intend to serve better than anyone else. You have to build authority. You have to be able to speak their language, right? So I completely believe in niching. If you're a contractor, you can niche down. That's fine. But if you own, if you're running a project, if you own the business and you look at all these people you have, all these creative experts, I wonder if many of them could be contributing more, except the titles get in the way, the expectations get in the way, that you've actually probably built a system to thinking that would please them, where each of them just did their part and then handed it to the next person, almost like an assembly line. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
But when, so for example, one of the first things we started doing was and people didn't care for this a lot in the first few days of it, but frankly, they loved it after a while. We would create project teams that would all work together in the same room at the same table. It wasn't every day of the week, but we would say, okay, for this week, you're working on the Green Goose project and we're going to get these four people. And we just started out in the conference room. We just said, you guys are going to take over the conference room and you're all going to work together side by side. A front, you know, somebody who thought of themselves as front end, somebody else who thought of themselves as back end, a designer and a copywriter. And we just put them all in this room, kind of locked them in a room. And we said, we're going to try and break the artificial barriers of everybody planning their own work lists, everybody planning, you know, exactly, how their sprints or their cadences work and how their review cycle work. We just want you to work together. So use each other's brains in lots of unexpected ways. And then we would just kind of go in on Monday and sit down and say, these are the big picture goals for the week. This is what we want everybody to be working on. Bring all your best skills, whatever they are. And we kind of locked the door, like, okay, you're locked in. We'll see everybody on Friday. And
you were creating your own little mini startup culture before this even happened.
right. I don't know. One of them compared it to like Big Brother, the show where they get locked in, locked into a room or something. But yeah, it was like a startup culture. And when you get to 20 people and all these different contractors, you start to think of yourself not as much as a startup, but more as a place where people plug into roles. And I really fell into that. And that was exhausting for me as the owner to manage and try and caretake these different roles, all while realizing that, you know, it's almost like, I think the phrase we used was, I feel like we're an orchestra playing on the Titanic as it's sinking. Like we weren't paying attention to the overall goal. Instead, we were doing our job. Our job is to play violin on the Titanic, or our job was to arrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. So instead, we really wanted to get everybody's brain focused on successful client delivery without worrying about as much about who did what.
That's awesome. I really like that.
And you know, to be honest, they really liked it too, because instead, I remember one of my partners was a really good programmer, and he would be one of the participants working in the projects in this room. And before, he used to always come to me with design feedback. And sometimes he would go to the designer and they would talk for 5 minutes and then leave. But now he could just swivel his monitor and say, what do you think about that? And then she'd say, oh, I think this needs to be here. And he'd say, oh, I like that. But, you know, they would actually have a conversation, and sitting side by side, every time he changed a color, every time he did anything, she actually stopped designing in Photoshop as much, trying to get every pixel perfect before she went into the room. Instead, she would have a very rough idea of what she wanted, and then have a lot of confidence that she could work with the programmers to make it even better because she'd get to experience it on the page.
I can definitely see the advantages of that sort of working as a team, not working as a team. We always tend to push towards working as a team, obviously, but taking on more than one role, being more active in every role and touching a little bit of every aspect. Because even, like I said, you know, it's just myself and Michael, and Michael has caught me out on more than one occasion with a UX update or upgrade. So, I mean, I don't even, like you said, I don't even dare to go and produce a, you know, a high def sketch or outlay now for any improvements or suspected improvements. We'll talk about it beforehand now, and if it comes down to it, it'll just be a napkin sketch, because Michael, you know, his feedback is just as valid as mine. And oftentimes he'll see something that I'm just not able to see, because, you know, this age old story of you're just way too focused on the issue to see so many of these areas just outside, you know, on the periphery of your vision. So I think getting that input from someone in a different place, from in a different area, can be really valuable, I think.
Yeah. For example, I was about 15 years older than a lot of the other folks that work there, and my eyes are not great, and I would have trouble reading white text on a light gray background, especially if it was like a very thin font. And they thought I was very silly. They're like, "Well, we're not designing for the elderly." And I'd say, "Look, if I'm struggling on my phone to see it, I guarantee that somebody else out there is going to struggle." So,
but it looks cool.
Oh, it does. And it looks so elegant. But I think
it looks cool, but no one can read it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's this idea that many people have: when you manage a creative expert, you should let them do kind of their thing, let them do whatever they want to do. And then the other thing is you should always honor whatever it is that they feel they're best at. And I think that is something that a lot of business, it's a trap that I fell into. Instead, I think you should give them a big goal and teach them that while they're a UX design expert, you really want their whole brain at work. And that while everybody does have a title on the business card, your role on the team is to positively contribute to solving the right problem and to shipping the product. So, yeah, you know, you have titles like designer and programmer and copywriter, but at the end of the day, your real role is about working together to bring all your expertise to do the right thing and build something great. And I think when you frame it that way, people like it, I think. I think it relieves them from having to be the one best in the world expert or the best in the team at something. And it also, like you said, it gives Michael, in your example, Nathan, it gives Michael that ability to creatively exercise his UX, you know, ideas. And probably, I know last week we talked, he was at a startup. I'll bet they didn't listen to his UX ideas at all. Probably they had some designer who lined it all out. So he probably feels much more satisfied with his work now.
So let's talk about another area, which I think is probably one of the biggest concerns or worries for anybody working with any kind of, whether it be a contractor or an employee, and that's actually getting the work in on time. You know, we all, you know, are up, you know, sweating, sleepless nights, you know, the deadline is looming and designer Jim hasn't handed over the final files and, you know, and developer Sarah hasn't finished, you know, the front end or whatever. How did you begin to deal with this in the agency? Because, you know, it is everyone's nightmare, I think, isn't it?
Oh, it never happened to us. I'm not even sure. No, I'm joking.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. Oh, people are late. And of course, we don't just find experts, you know, creative experts are late. But have you noticed that creative experts seem to be late more often than other kinds of people? Or is that just me?
Well, I don't know. Next to clients, they could be second.
I don't know. Well, that's true. That's another podcast, right? Managing clients. And
Managing clients, yeah.
Yeah, it can be very difficult because I know for us, when I'm trying to think if I have a reasonable answer to this, I hope I do, but oftentimes we would ask people, all right, Sarah, when do you think this can be done? And, you know, kind of the standard project manager answer is get the estimate from the person and then pad it. Maybe you double it. So if she says it's going to take 4 days, you write down 8 days or something like that. I used to do that a lot and never could kind of find the right multiplier. And I never wanted them to know I was doing it because I would always be fearful that they would, that they would start to be offended or maybe they'd pad their estimates. It really shows like a lack of trust. If somebody says,
I was just going to say, do you think as well that it's different between dealing with external contractors and in-house team members when it comes to this about getting work delivered on time? Do you think there's any difference there for how you would actually manage the situation?
Well, they're practically, usually there is. With the person who's a full-timer, you're going to usually talk with them a lot more often. And oftentimes they're more comfortable telling you before the 11th hour that things haven't gone well and they need more time. I can't stand it when contractors accept a piece of work and then don't tell you it's not going to be delivered and they need another week until a few hours or the day before it's due. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem for me. And so if you're managing these kinds of people, a couple of things come to mind. One, I now only, I always do and I always accept estimates as ranges. And as soon as I say that, people get confused. Why do you talk about estimates as ranges? And I tell them it's because, well, I don't know the future and I don't think you know the future. You don't know when you're going to, you know, get sick. You don't know what else might come up and you don't know how, even if everything's perfect, you don't know how hard or easy the work's going to be really because you've never done this. So let's start estimating in ranges. And I ask people, contractors and employee full-timers now, for sort of a range. So it could be instead of saying, what day will I get this on? I will say, what's your range of when it could be delivered? Give me the soonest and the latest. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking for two numbers. I'm looking for, it could be two sets of hours. Like they say it takes 10 to 20. When is it going to be delivered? Well, it could be as soon as Tuesday and as late as the following Friday. Okay. So now you have two numbers. And now the discussion can migrate just a little bit and you can ask the person, what factors did you consider as you gave me those two numbers? Because when you just ask for a single number, right, like 5 hours or I'll have it to you Friday, you have no idea what's going on in the person's head, right? It's very difficult to read. It could be just pressure. You might actually be artificially pressuring them to give you unrealistic estimates. So I always ask for two estimates. And then I ask for the factors. I say, okay, what would cause the low estimate to become more accurate? And they'll rattle off a set of things. Usually those are risks that weren't a problem. And then I'll say, oh, what about the high estimate? What could cause us to be in a high estimate situation? Oh, and then they'll talk about all these things that oftentimes I wasn't even aware of. Concerns they had, risks they weren't talking about. And then we usually have a discussion where we will usually change the estimate ranges together. Because we are talking about the probability of risk, you know, how likely is it that this is going to happen? Or maybe I'll say, well, what if I could bring somebody else to help you with this? That would be very helpful and things like that. So that's one of the first ways I avoid the uncomfortable, awful, terrible time of having somebody not deliver on time is I really change the definition of what on time means.
Yeah, because I think it's as much the contractor's ultimate nightmare as it probably is the project manager's nightmare. You know, I mean, obviously speaking as if the contractor is a responsible person, but a responsible human right. being. I think there are a few different types of contractors, aren't there? There are those who will always go up against the deadline because that's the way they best work.
Yeah.
And there are those that will work, you know, at a steady, continuous pace. For example, Nuria, my wife, she could only work against the deadline, you know, and she will leave it until the last minute and she will stay up all night and she will get it done.
And it will be brilliant, right?
And it will be brilliant, but, you know, not everyone likes to work that way and not everyone can. But I think if you can take that sort of level of stress away, I think, you know, in the way that you've mentioned of working between these two sort of time ranges, I think that could be very helpful both for the contractor, or in this case, the employee, and also for the project manager. I quite like that a lot.
The other thing I do, the other thing I do is I check in with people very, very regularly. And sometimes we, if the project, if something is going to take longer than a week, or I will set up interstitial review milestones, but I literally check in with people every day. And if we're in an office, I just manage by walking around. That's actually a management style invented by Hewlett-Packard. And it's the idea of you just kind of walking around, observing what people are doing, looking over their shoulder. You're not necessarily bothering them or micromanaging them, but you're being with them alongside. And when they know that you're there, they become very quick to say, oh, Marcus, take a look at this. How does that what you were expecting? And, oh yeah, that looks great, Susie, or whatever. Those moments when you're just kind of mingling around, and sometimes virtual teams will do it with Slack, but I think that it's a management technique that you have to make clear to everybody that you're walking around to be a resource to them, to very quickly answer their questions, get feedback, give feedback, things like that. And so I found that just by being really present, oftentimes I would pick up on problems extremely early. Like when Susie says, how does this look? And it does not at all seem like what you had in mind. You can have a discussion then, not one where anybody's penalized because they'll never ask you to look at it again, but one where you say, oh, well, how much do you feel you've gotten done? Or where are you in your project work? And I don't know, does that make sense?
Totally, yeah. I think it was probably one of the sort of eureka moments for me as well, because I'd always worked remotely. I hadn't worked sort of in-house for a long time. And even if it was in-house, it was only on a consulting contract. So I think one of the biggest lessons learned for me was something along a similar lines, but just in a remote sense, is that before, when I was contracting, I'd always be very fearful of the sort of the presentation moment, you know, the whole da-da, tell me what you think.
Right.
It's always petrifying, you know, as much for the contractor as it is for the client, you know. So I changed that way of working as well. And I would check in as often as I could. It was so that it never got to that surprise presentation moment. It was a continual, you know, this is where I am today. And it was, in my case, it wasn't necessarily a daily thing, but it would be a few times a week where we'd check in, we'd hook up via Skype, and I'd actually go through what, you know, where I was at, what I was thinking, and get feedback and move from there. And that was a big game changer for me as a freelance designer. You know, instead of putting off those touchstone moments to basically right at the end of the project when it's too late to do anything about anything anyway, I would move that up to be a regular thing, you know, weekly, bi-weekly, whatever the case might be. And it really did help, as it helps remove those stress levels for starting. And I think it also helps build the client relationship as well. You know, they feel a lot more comfortable around you. You feel a lot more comfortable around them. And I think in most cases as well, it usually ended up resulting in repeat work.
I love that. I think if you're an expert and you're listening to this and you do work for clients, or you're an employee and you work for a creative company, that hat that we wear, I call it sometimes different modes that we're in. I think about it as wearing a hat. The expert hat sometimes means that we have to have a big reveal where it's perfect, right? That it's just ta-da. And then, like, because that's how experts work, is we get it right the first time and we present it and it's perfect. And people are just jaw-droppingly over the moon happy with our work. Mm-hmm. But that is so wrong, and it has so much pressure.
It's such a crock. It's if that ever was the way, which it was, at least that was the way I thought I was supposed to work, you know, back in the day. But I don't know anybody who works like that now. Not anybody who's good at what they do.
Right.
Anybody who's good at what they do is working from the client right from the very get-go to the end, you know, and there is constant back and forth. And I don't mean via email saying, here's where I am, you know, as close to the real world situation as, you know, as you can be. In this case, for me, Skype was that tool, you know, and yeah, invaluable.
Yeah, I think real experts welcome feedback. They know that they really depend on the client's, you know, these conversations and discussions. And like you said, nobody who's really good is waiting for a final big reveal, even though that seems so ego feeding. It's just wonderful. I think it's more junior experts, if I can use that phrase, who don't want to show their work. So if you're managing junior experts, if you have a designer who's a couple years out of school and has gotten some skills, or a programmer who's been doing their craft for 2 to 3 years, they might think of themselves as an expert. You probably should, be encouraging them to share more rather than just impress everyone. Because the big ta-da moment really is meant to impress people, right?
Sure. And I think certainly for designers, I wouldn't say it's more difficult perhaps, because I can't speak from the perspective of another kind of creative worker, but I think it's definitely difficult for us to show work before it's, before it's what we consider it to be done. And I think that's a big reason why many designers still don't do that, but it's like anything. The more you push yourself to do it, the easier it becomes, the more you can show just, rough napkin sketches, initial layouts, however you choose to do that, whether that's in an app or on paper or a sketch, whatever, and then actually go through, the more you can force yourself to do it, the easier it does become. But I'm not denying that's a hard thing to do, especially with designers, because we're supposed to be a visual breed. So it can be hard to get over, but once you get over that, the benefits are huge.
Yeah, I want to ask you about a situation, Nathan, because I had a situation with my designer, and this has been years ago, but I found it so interesting, her reaction. And I'd love to, because as her manager, it surprised me. So I want you to put on your designer hat, and I want to tell you about this situation. Maybe you can help me understand the expert designer's mind, okay?
Okay.
So we were doing this project, and this gal, this designer, we'll call her Susie, and she was quite a good designer. She was maybe 4 years out of school. She was starting to learn UX design, but had done a lot of visual design for web and mobile and even print and things like that. And we had a client who we were moving pretty fast with, and we wanted to try prototyping ideas in code to put in front of him, and so that he could actually show investors. So the idea was we do what we called a low fidelity, HTML prototype, a click-through prototype. I don't know if you've ever heard of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we actually told the designer, we said, we don't want it to be pixel perfect. We want it to be like, it can't be ugly, but don't make it really beautiful. And our main concern here was don't spend a lot of time on it, because it's probably going to get thrown away. It's probably going to get radically changed. And it was hard for her at the beginning. It was actually hard for her all the way through to kind of learn to work in a quick and dirty, low fidelity way, but still work in Photoshop or Illustrator. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why it was hard, but like you say, I think it was that, maybe it was that resistance to not making it perfect, but
I think there are a few things. I think insecurity comes into play. We want people to think that we're good. We are, we're there to do our job. In this case, I am a designer, and that's my identity, right? This is what you were saying was part of the problem of running an agency. We cling so dearly to our identities that it can become a problem. And part of that, I think, is I am a designer and I need to do a really good job. And so I think a lot of times, even when you are doing those initial mock-ups, it's very easy for us designers to spend way too much time doing those initial mock-ups because we want people to like them. I think it's possibly only when you go into business for yourself or when you've spent enough time with clients that you can see, well, actually, it's not beneficial. It's far quicker and easier for the end client as well to see a quick click-through model than something that's going to confuse them every time they see it because it looks like a finished article. But I think insecurity has got a lot to do with that, because we want the end client to think that we're good and to know that we're good, and we all like to feel valued. Designers are our end products, at least in our minds, I think, until we can make that change, that the sort of switch from visual to business result. Pixel perfect was a big sort of catchphrase, wasn't it? It's sort of 10 years ago when everything was still all Photoshop and we aspired to be pixel perfect. And now I don't think it's very rare you even hear anybody sort of mention that anymore. Things have changed. I think it's just partly because, there are no shadows or anything anymore. There are no bevels. It's all flat design. So, you wouldn't know if there was a pixel out of place anyway. But, I think once you realize that it's about the end result of the business and not about sort of the end result sort of how you're perceived as a person or as a designer. I think it becomes clearer. I don't think I'm explaining myself very clearly. I think it's just once you realize that you're helping a business on a bigger level rather than just a pixel perfect design, then I think that's when it becomes easier to accept that not everything needs to be perfect. The overall picture needs to be awesome, not the individual parts of that picture. Does that make sense?
It does. And I saw that insecurity in her that people wouldn't like it. So I remember one time, she was super stressed out that we were going to show the client. And we'd actually built a functioning prototype that in theory he could go to market with. But the design was really minimal, not in like a sexy minimal way, but like a quick and dirty minimal way.
Minimal way, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it stressed her out. And I pulled her aside and I said, because I just didn't understand. I said, why is this causing you so much stress? And she goes, I am so afraid that he's going to say, this is good enough. Let's get it to market. And I said, that seems like it would be a really positive thing. And she goes, no, we designed it. I designed it. What will people think about me and us? Like, it looks terrible. I'm so ashamed of it. And that was the core of her fear about letting it go, was if you're going to release it out into the wild, it's representing me.
Totally. And I think it's the difference as well between that big picture thing and that individual thing. Like you were saying, this is what's on my business card, but I'm actually part of a team. I think it all ties in very nicely because, you know, you could have shipped that product probably for that client if he'd said, you know, that's great, let's go with it, because maybe in his mind, or maybe actually in the real world, the results would have been awesome because that was the end goal. The end goal was perhaps, let's just say, to increase trial signups. And if through her rough mock-up, that goal had been achieved, then kudos, you know?
Right.
She could have spent a week more designing that, and perhaps the end goal would have failed. So therefore, would she have really felt better about herself? You know, yes, she would have had a kick-ass design, but it would have failed in its end goal. So it's that whole individual security, insecurity against the global picture. And I think that ties in exactly with what you were saying at the beginning about, you know, running a team and this is who I am. I am my job title.
Yeah. And the client actually took it and raised $500,000 in venture capital funding and was extraordinarily happy. And we were happy. And she was happy.
Mortified.
But, you know, she was like, oh, I see the benefit. And so I love what you just said, Nathan. Like, had she spent another week on it, the exact same amount of money would have been raised. And so if you sort of look at it by almost any definition, an extra week put into that would have yielded exactly the same result would have been waste. It would have been overproduction. It would have been unnecessary to the final goal. And I think that oftentimes creative experts, and by the way, all the insecurities you were talking about with designers are exhibited in programmers. You may not believe it that programmers can feel that way, but they absolutely do.
I know they do. Michael wants to rewrite the app every week. So
right. And it's not because anyone on the outside can see. It's about what the app says about him, his skills, his abilities, his professionalism, his brilliance. Yeah. There's a principle in agile software development that is almost always overlooked because programmers don't talk about it. They don't like it. And the principle is we need to maximize the amount of work not done. And that word "not" in there really throws people. And it's this idea of if you could solve a problem without writing any software, that would be the right solution. And if you could solve a problem without doing any new design, that would be a better solution because it's cheaper, there's fewer bugs. Like, there's all these advantages to doing less. But we as creative experts instinctively think that we should be measured by doing more and more and more of everything.
Oh, completely. It's the classic client request. I need a new website design. You know, as a designer, that's something we jump on and perhaps wouldn't even question. But, you know, do they need a new web design? You know, do they just need to update the one they've got and still get the exact same result? Sometimes we don't look, you know, out of our own self-interest and perhaps even just wanting to, you know, work exclusively on our specialty, which is designing again. We just say, yeah, that'd be awesome. I can redesign the whole thing for you again. But do we need to be redesigning the whole thing again? You know, are we just creating work for the sake of it?
Right.
Can we just update it and get even better results?
You know, I think real experts, and not just people who are in a role and who are a couple years out of school, but real seasoned experts, whether they're in the company or they're working for clients, will ask exactly that question. Do we need, we could do this work. Do we need to? Does it accomplish the goal? And in some ways, I hate to say it, but I know people, quite a few folks at bigger agencies, and they love to hire junior experts, the designers and the programmers right out of school, who are more than happy to do any kind of work that the salespeople can sell. Mm-hmm. It's the senior, the truly senior experts, though, that oftentimes are harder for that agency, big agencies, to work with, because they're constantly questioning, do we really need to do this project when it's already been sold and it's already been planned, right? And then your senior lead designer raises his hand and says, do we really need to redo a full redesign? Well, we're going to get, you know, $500,000 for that. So the business owner is going, yes, it doesn't matter if it's effective. We're going to do it because of the money. And the senior person is saying, I really want to make sure that the work I do is impactful. I want it to have the right outcome. So I think you can leverage this desire. Bigger companies, bigger agencies, I don't, like, they're money machines. We'll take them out of the mix. If you're a small creative company, what you should get from this whole talk is that you need to help your people understand the real value of the work that they're doing. Work in an environment where it is safe to show things along the way, right? And help. I think if you get them in front of the customer more often and let them see how the customer feels about their work, oftentimes they'll start to see that it's not all about them and how people perceive them. It's actually about what this other paying person needs to accomplish. And sometimes that can be a low fidelity, quick and dirty design that raises $500,000.
100%. Love it. And I'm so happy that that design managed to raise that money. I'm sure that was a huge life lesson for that designer.
Oh, they were shocked. They actually said, I can't believe anyone would invest in something so ugly. And I said, okay, it's not that it's ugly to you, but to the rest of us, it seems fine. And they're like, well, yeah, it's fine, but it's not great. And I said, well, maybe not everything has to be great to be effective. So that lesson also taught us as leaders, help the people doing the work really understand the goals, really understand. And that meant we had to go to the client more often and understand the real goals. In this case, it was about raising money. In other cases, it's like you said, it's just about getting more signups or about making some part of the app. I bet there's parts of Newsy that almost no one goes into more than twice a year, right? The settings screen or things like that. Should a designer put as much thought into that place as they do the thing that people use every single time they visit? Well, I don't know. I think there's an interesting discussion to happen around where we need to apply our efforts. So, yeah. Anyway. Fantastic. That was a bit rambly. Sorry.
No. I totally agree. And I think, yeah, that whole knowing the actual end goal of the client, I think can help sort of define the entire project and define what actually everybody involved in that project does instead of just focusing on their speciality. You know, is it going to help move, you know, the project towards the end goal, which in this case was raising money? It could have been something else. And depending what the end goal is also should, I think, in my mind at least, completely change the course of the way we work as well. Because, you know, a designer designing a web page for something that's going to increase trial signups is not going to work in the same way, or rather not going to design the same way for maybe a website that is looking to just gain exposure for their new book that's coming up or whatever, you know?
Right.
If you don't know what the end goal is, you can't work to the best of your abilities. And I think that changes a lot as well. I guess that's probably about time, is it, for today?
Well, it seems like a natural ending. Cast a vision, tell people what the big goal is, and then encourage them to work together without worrying about who gets the credit or what title they have. And I think you'll find that your people get to use different parts of their brain, and they're going to bring a lot more enthusiasm to the project. And hopefully they'll stop thinking in silos, which is frustrating for everybody.
And lots of sharing as well, you know, lots, like yeah. you were saying before, lots of internal sharing, lots of external sharing, bring down yes. those sort of embarrassment barriers.
Absolutely.
It's going to go a long way, I think.
Completely. Absolutely.
All right, then. Well, I think we'll leave it there for this week. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about on the podcast, just drop us a line, podcast@thecreativebusinesspodcast.com, and we'll see what we can do. So have a fantastic weekend, Marcus, and we'll be back same time next week, right?
Right. You as well. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.